Brand from the university. She'll be here for the next 3 weeks or so. So lots of times questions and things. And she's talking about what we can learn about physics from the adiabatic computation.
Thank you. And thank you very much for the invitation. Yes, well, people have asked me for the past few days, what are you working on? When I say adiabatic quantum computation, of course, people tend to think I'm trying to build a fast quantum computer. That's an adiabatic quantum computer. While that in itself is probably an interesting thing, what motivates me is more to use models of quantum computing to learn more about physics, hopefully. And that's what I added because we just started this program. Why do I think it's interesting? As I said before, the adiabatic quantum computation itself is interesting because what has been shown to be computationally equivalent to the Stamped model of quantum computation, so what you learn there, you can probably transfer what you know about other quantum computers. And it might be more robust against errors of certain kinds, so that would be interesting. Also, when you try to calculate something in this model, you have some systems that look very simple. You start with very small systems, but you learn very soon that they're not as simple as they look. You find some interesting things about fundamental physics, easily. The advantage of adiabatic quantum computation as compared to the standard model is that you can easily track time-dependent quantities. I will show you why very soon. And what I like especially about it is that it provides a natural connection to quantum field theory. That's where I come from originally, so I'm probably a little biased about that. Quantum mechanics for me is just field theory in 0 plus 1 dimensions. So if you have that connection, you can probably describe spin models, which can be used for the implementation of quantum computation in a more natural way. So that's what I hope we can go with that in the future. So how do we approach this? Right now we are studying the dynamics of entanglement and other physical quantities during the adiabatic algorithms. That's something that, as far as I know, has not been done before. Just very little bit by Roman Olus and Dottore, but there's more focus on the scaling of the dynamic entanglement with the size of the quantum computer. So we started with very small systems, and if somebody was at Theory Canada last year, I presented very few very early talks about that. And what we have done recently is extending this approach, almost doing an experimental approach, just looking at what happens in the quantum computer while it's doing the calculation. This is some work I've been doing with Gabor Kunstad and Bernie Copes in Winnipeg, and Meg Carrington and Todd Fugelberg in Brandon, and we also had two students in each of those places. This is the basic idea of the adiabatic quantum computer, and you see it's really simple. You start with an input state that is supposed to be easy to construct. That's what the experiment is. And you want to end up in the final state ψ1, which is somehow the solution of the problem that you want to solve. And what you do, how you achieve that final state, is by continuous time evolution, not with discrete gates as you do in the standard circuit model of quantum computing. How do you do that? You drive the system from the initial to the final state with a time-dependent Hamiltonian. You kind of force it to end up in the state where you want it to be. How do you construct that time-dependent Hamiltonian? Well, you consider those two states, ψ0 and ψ1, make up two Hamiltonians for which these two states are the ground states, and then you build a linear combination of these two Hamiltonians. So these two functions, f and g, they just turn on one part of the Hamiltonian and turn off the other part. So f will just go down from 1 to 0, and g will just go up. That's the idea. Now, how do you make the system actually stay in the ground state, as you want it to do? You make sure that the evolution is slow enough. If you have a Hamiltonian that is not time dependent, and you start up in the ground state of your system, you would assume that you stay in the ground state. Now, if you change your Hamiltonian slowly enough, similar things happen. And this is made more formal with the adiabatic theorem that I've shown there. You consider the instantaneous energy eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. You need the minimum gap between the two lowest eigenstates, and then you just have to make sure that the time evolution of the Hamiltonian is so that this condition here is fulfilled. If you do that, after your running time, that's capital T, your computer will end up in the state that you want it to end up in, ψ1, with probability of all multiple. The full epsilon can be considered the error of the computation. Now, I've tried to compare the standard model with the adiabatic computation a little bit. In both cases, you consider qubits or whatever you want, it can be continuous variables, although, as far as I know, that has not been done for the adiabatic quantum computations. But for the standard model, you have a sequence of gates, three sequence of gates, whereas for the adiabatic model, you have this time-dependent Hamiltonian and therefore a continuous time equation. And that also makes a big difference in what you could use this quantum computer for. The idea of the standard model quantum computation is to have something that is universally usable, a general purpose computer, whereas in the adiabatic model, you have a special purpose computer. If you want, you can maybe compare that to these integration and differentiation circuits, right? You know, those that are just built for the sole purpose of integrating and differentiating something. So in this case, in the adiabatic case, the software and the hardware are somehow interconnected. Whereas for the standard model, you have a difference between the hardware, which is the quantum computer, and the software that you want to run on. So the adiabatic version is much more just a physical system that you start. And in the standard model, you start with a classical input, you run your quantum algorithm, and you do your measurement, you have a classical output. I think you don't have to do that in the adiabatic model. You could, if you want, probably end up in a quantum state and use it as the input for another calculation. So just to give you an idea of what the difference is.
If somebody comes up with a good adiabatic algorithm that does something amazing, like solves a pretty hard problem, then is it possible to simulate the that standard model of quantum computing?
I think you could translate that back.
Okay.
You can just,
so,
yeah.
So in a sense, the adiabatic quantum computer, you could think of it also as a kind of a paradigm for designing algorithms, where you don't really, because based on that, you don't actually have to build anything. You just use that as a source of inspiration, and then you use a class standard.
Yep. That would be very nice, actually. If you could do that. Now, to give you an example of the adiabatic quantum computation, at this sort of search algorithm in the adiabatic version, the task is, well, we have some unsorted database, some pile of things, which is usually called the haystack. And one of these things is marked. And this is what you're supposed to mark. Now, in a quantum system, this pile of things is realized as this superposition state, haystack, psi zero. Just every state appears with the same probability. And the marked state, M, is the final state, that's the needle in the haystack you're supposed to find. And of course, you have to do it as quick as possible. Now, following the recipe from earlier, you construct this Hamiltonian, this independent Hamiltonian, with the two projection operators on the initial and the final state. And just so I don't forget it, I wrote that down, that we choose the marked state to be the zero state. That's without loss of generality, just for the notation. For those of you who know the Grover search algorithm, these two parts of the Hamiltonian are very similar, actually, to the operator that shows up in the Grover search. That's what the Hamiltonian looks like for a large system. You can calculate the eigenvectors and the eigenvalues. Those e plus and e minus are the two lowest eigenvalues. And you can determine the running time from the adiabaticity condition. So what you have in this case is just, in general, you have a system where this is your lowest energy idle state, and that's the first energy state, and you're supposed to stay in this state for the whole time. I think later in some other transparencies I've called this one E minus and this E plus, just to confuse.
Sorry. Are F and G time dependent?
Yes, sorry, I just didn't write that anymore. Because for now everything is time dependent. Those functions, the energy eigenstates, the eigenvalues. That's right. Now, what is interesting, I find, is what makes these quantum computations work. What allows the speed up, what makes the whole thing work in general. And of course, there are several suggestions for the resources for quantum computation. Of course, energy and time, that's just a natural thing. That's what you already have in a classical computer. And Shorya and Gabor and Randy have been working on that a while ago. Some people even state that this last point measurement could be considered a resource for quantum computation. I want to talk about that. The two in the middle, I think, are the ones that are debated most. That's the Hilbert space structure. Some people would say that allows a kind of parallel computation, and the entanglement of our locality.
Oh, I assume you're finished with your adiabatic robots first. I just wanted to ask, so do you get the same scaling? Do you get the square root of n runtime?
Yeah. Yes, with a certain modification that I haven't mentioned yet, I'll mention later. Is that okay? But in principle, yes.
Can I ask also about the search? Maybe you could either, well, you might mention it later too, but I did want to know whether, you know, are you aware of this continuous time search algorithm that paper by Fargy and Gutman? This sort of
yes, that's what this is.
Does it boil down to the same?
Yeah. Okay. So they came up with what they called an analog in the beginning, yeah. I think, which was driving Hamiltonian. And based on that, some other groups.
I'm asked because if you look at the paper, it doesn't look adiabatic the way they analyzed it. It looks like they're using a different approach than maybe the underlying.
Do you mean the first one?
1996, I think.
Yeah. That's kind of a predecessor to the actual adiabatic one. That's just the continuous time version of the driving Hamiltonian. And it's a constant,
right?
Yeah. Exactly.
But is that an adiabatic?
No.
No. Okay.
No, but later they did that.
Yeah, okay.
So what is entanglement? Just as a brief reminder. Well, a state that cannot be written as a product state of two single qubit states in the case of a system that consists of two parts. That would be considered entangled. For example, the single Bell state that you can write like that, you cannot write as a product of two single qubit states. So that means that the state of the whole system is known completely to you, but the state of each subsystem, which I will call A and B in the future, is not. So they are in these states. and this idea is used for information-based definition of time. Do you agree?
Well, in my point of view, the state of subsystem is always completely determined by the state of the host.
Yes, but if you can't write it down, it's not.
Of course, it's
that's the idea.
Your state.
Yeah. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. Did I work it? Oh. So what you can do for bicontact systems in a pure state, you define the entropy of entanglement as the phenomenal entropy of one of the subsystems, either of the subsystems. Meaning you trace out one of the subsystems, you get the reduced density matrix for system A or B, and you write down the phenomenal entropy for that reduced density matrix. You do that, you calculate that by using the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix. So as soon as you know those, you'll find that you can calculate your entropy of entanglement. As far as I know, this is the only case where people actually agree on a proper measure of entanglement. Bipartite system in pure state. There have been many suggestions for other measures of entanglement for other bigger systems, multi-partite systems, or mixed states, etc. But I think there's no general agreement so far about what to use there. But we'll stay with these simple systems for a while. Now, we started with a very small system, the most simple quantum computer you can possibly imagine, that's two qubits. So you have the state that I write on a computational basis. I just show this for notation. I, you know, the component the C's. This is the density matrix of the whole state, and I apologize for the missing spaces in there. This is 4x4. Right? And this is the reduced density matrix for one of the subs. So from this, if you write that down, you will find the eigenvalues, u plus and u minus. From that, you can calculate the entropy of entanglement. That's all very nice. Now, it becomes even nicer when you use the adiabatic quantum computer, because in that case, you have all these coefficients time-dependent, you can calculate the density matrix at a time event function, and then you can just write down the eigenvalues as a function of time. And from that, you can calculate the entropy of entanglement as a function of time as well. So you can just track the dynamics. Now, when you do that, you will find the first result, what happens during the search algorithm. You start off with a global state, a non-entangled state. You end up in a non-entangled state. But in the middle, during the algorithm, in the running time, entropy is produced and destroyed. That's interesting. It's not very much. It's far below the maximum value of 1 we could achieve, but it's some. Now, the interesting question is this entanglement necessary for the speedup, for this whole thing to work, or is it just a byproduct of the time evolution anyway? How can we find that?
Question here. So, if you vary the size, does the peak get more narrow? That's the first question. Second question, does it, the tip of the peak, does it coincide with the smallest energy gap?
How would that come out?
No, that's a question.
At the time, you mean?
Yeah.
Yes, of course. That's how the entanglement, how the Hamiltonian is set up, right?
A priori, it is not clear to me. I would suspect it, that you have maximum entanglement when you have a minimum gap.
Mm-hmm.
It is like that.
It's in this case, it is.
Okay.
As soon as you start changing the system, it changes a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what we did, to change the system a bit. So we walked away from the initial state, used another input, which has a different entanglement. That means, in practical terms, you don't have a search where all the elements can be picked with the same probability to ratio of different probabilities, if you want to interpret that as a search. For example, you can look at the most extreme case, the Bell state, as the initial state on the right. It starts with entanglement of 1 as maximum entanglement. Somehow has to go down to 0 to end up in that one state, which is computational state. You can look at anything in between with entanglement of 0.3 something, 0.8 or so, and you will always find that type of behavior. Either if you have states that are close to the state that you want to end up in, it just goes down monotonically. Or if you have states that are far away from your final state, it somehow is produced and then goes down. That's a typical behavior you find. And it seems the further away the initial state is from the final state, the larger the difference between initial entanglement and maximum entanglement. So it seems more needs to be produced or more is produced. We don't know yet. I should mention this state on the left, this one here, that has a Hamiltonian that uses the same spectrum as the original initial state that I showed you first, and it has the same running time. So that would support the assumption that the running time of the algorithm is more determined by the spectrum, the energy that is there, than by the entanglement. Then, so third point here says, for states further away from the marked state, more entanglement is created during the search. And we also know that the speedup that is achieved in the quantum search is related to the overlap of the initial and final state, which in turn has to do with the dimension of the Hilbert space, so the capital N. So that says that we should somehow investigate this overlap of fidelity of the states, the influence of that on the running time of the algorithm. And of course, one should look at a larger N, a larger system, not just 2 qubits, and possibly other algorithms. That's why I'm happy that you suggested other algorithms, because we would need some more to look at. So first, I'll show you something about the fidelity that we looked at in the middle. These are just some states that we used. They all start with the initial entanglement of 0. So they're all kind of symmetric. But they have different fidelity as initial states, by which I mean the fidelity of the initial and final state, where you want to end up. And you find what you would expect when the initial fidelity is small, you have a large running time. So if you are far away from the desired state, before it takes longer to get there. That's not very surprising. But you've also found a correlation, the larger the maximum value of the entanglement is, the larger is the running time. So that would support the conclusion, a large entanglement is bad for the algorithm, right, and make it slower. If you want to read the running time from these graphs, you can use graph epsilon max, right? Epsilon, as you might remember, is the error, that would be allowed in your computation, determined by the adiabatic theorem. So if you allow, you have a graph like that. Here, epsilon, here, time. If you allow this error of epsilon, this would be the running time that you get. So what is higher up has a larger running time. That's how you read it. So this looks like a possible interesting correlation, but if you make some further investigations, it doesn't hold. The next thing we looked at was the Deutsch-Jascher algorithm. That's one that is less intuitive than the search algorithm. It's more of a static interest, I would think. It has to determine, or it's used to determine whether a function is constant or balanced. And I just wrote down the example for the simplest case. You have four possible outcomes for this function. And if all outputs are identical, the function is called constant. If you have equal number of zeros with ones, it's called balanced. So in the classical case, you would have to look at both outputs, f of 0 and f of 1, to find out if the function is constant or balanced. And if you do a quantum version of this algorithm, just one measurement gives you the result. This quantum version has been introduced also by Shorya and Gabor and Andretti a while ago. So what they did was they wrote down the initial state as the equally weighted superposition, just as a search algorithm. And for the final state, Simon, they chose, well, what is written there? The combination of the state 0 and the superposition of all the other computational vector states. And depending on whether you have a constant or a balanced function, that depends, that determines your coefficients alpha and beta. It's a bit technical, so don't worry about that, it's not very pretty. The interesting point is you can just measure once and you get the result. If you get the 0 of the measurement, your function is constant. If you don't get the 0, it's balanced. That's it. You might note if you have this case, the constant case, that's the same as our search algorithm for our choice of the final state because we chose 0 as the final state. So we have one less case to consider. Now what happens here is you find one of the correlations that we had before. If you have a small initial fidelity, you have a large running time again. That's not very surprising. But the correlation between the entanglement and the running time you cannot find. For once, because you don't have a maximum, because it just goes from 0 to 1. And you wouldn't know where to look. You could look in the middle of the time evolution if you want, but there's no really physically compelling reason why you should do that. So you can't really draw conclusions from that. Now, you can look at a larger system. Not much larger, it's just 3 qubits. But already there you run into problems because, well, you have to know how to define or calculate the entropy of entanglement there. Now you have 3 qubits, and which ones do you trace up? And when you look at it and you write down, for example, the entropy of entanglement, both the cases change depending on which ones you trace up. Now, if this already varies, could it be that our result from the running time, etc., also change when you change the definition of entanglement? Could be possible. So what we tried was an alternative definition of entanglement. Not something fancy mathematically, axiomatically motivated. We're not that clever. Just physically motivated. So what we did was we measured the entanglement geometrically by taking the distance between the state that we consider and the closest product state. So we take some space that is somehow parameterized by the coefficient of the product state and see which one is the closest. This expression here, P, is just a general expression for product state, where the coefficients A and B come from. C is our state that we consider. And you end up with this function to be minimal, for the minimal distance. The first part here should be 1 because the state should be 1.
So what definition of distance are you using between the states? It gives you that function of the coefficients?
Or just the length of the d, the distance d. Like
that. Including the two on the vector.
Nothing.
if you would change the sign of B, say, that wouldn't change some physical state. But the difference between C and P is different from the distance of C and minus P.
Yep.
So we are minimizing over the C's. Yes.
Okay. Oh yeah, thanks. That's awesome.
Why do you call it the closest perfect state? The one in the green? Why do you call it the closest?
No, sorry, that's just the general cross product state. Yeah. Should have written a different. Few remarks about that measure. It has an advantage over the entropy of entanglement because you can just generalize it when you have more than two subsystems A and B. So you don't have the problem anymore of how to partition your system or which qubits to trace out. Okay, that's nice. It is very similar to the Hilbert-Schmidt distance, for those of you who know that, but it has the advantage that it's a little bit faster to calculate numerically. Now, we found something that we don't really understand when trying to find the minimum of that function D. When you write down the condition for that function to become minimal, you end up with this condition here, where this MA and MB come from the length of the product state that I mentioned before. So it's a little strange, because this looks exactly like the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix, but the condition for the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix. That's this condition. So it seems that these eigenvalues are somehow determined by the length of the closest product state, and it's not normalized. We don't really know what that means, so we'd be grateful for any kind of contribution to that. That was the interpretation more detailed, anybody's interested in it. Now this is a result if you look at the search algorithm, the entanglement with those two different functions. One is entropy of entanglement, and the other one is the minimized B. And you see the positive behavior is exactly the same, just the numbers are a little different. So for the small system of two qubits, you really don't learn anything new. It's maybe a confirmation that it makes sense to measure entanglement in these two different ways. The physics seems to be the same. Find that kind of comfortable in a way. Now, while we're at it, why don't we define another measure to for distance as well, not just the fidelity, but a kind of other geometrical measure for the distance. You know, as I said in the beginning, it's more an experimental approach, just trying to see what happens if we look at the system in different ways. So one function that was suggested was this function capital G. You just take the components of the states, the one that you consider as the final state, and component-wise, you just add up the difference. It's kind of related to one norm, but it's different. Now, if you do that, you can compare that to the function, and just for convenience, we don't compare it to the fidelity directly, but to 1 minus the fidelity. That's what I wrote down. Now, this new function G has an interesting property. I'll show you in the next slide. This is this shows your entropy of entanglement together with the fidelity. What you see is the entropy of entanglement has a maximum where the fidelity has what's called inflection point. And the higher the maximum of the entropy of entanglement is, the steeper is the slope. So if you want to consider the fidelity, that kind of, well, the fidelity is a distance. So the time derivative of the fidelity would be a kind of velocity, how fast you move from your instantaneous state to the final state. So that means the velocity is somehow related to the maximum of the entanglement. It seems it's almost at the same time, not exactly. When you look at this function G, it is actually at the same time. There's another property of this function that we don't understand why that happens. You can't really see from this, but if you plot the first derivative of the entropy of entanglement, the second derivative of the G, you see the first. So there might be a correlation there as well. Now, I come back to your question about the result of the Rolle search. With those functions, those linear functions, F and G, you do not get the same speed up. You just get the test result. You just avoid capital N. But if you optimize this time function, this MNG, you achieve the same speed up as the global search. Now, you do that in the following way. What is shown there is again the adiabaticity condition for the epsilon, and how you determine the running time capital T. The S is just the dimension of the time variable. Now, what you can do is you do not apply this adiabaticity condition in the same way to the whole time evolution, but you apply it to each time interval separately. And that makes sense because, well, only here where the gap is small, you have to be really, really slow with the time evolution, right? Here and here you can be fast. So instead of having a function S and a function of T that goes like that, you have something that can go fast in the beginning, then slow, and then fast again, something like that. And if you do that, you get your optimized running time of Victor here from solving these little unpleasant intervals. Now, if you do that for the search algorithm, still the small system of 2 qubits, but this time the optimized one time, you see, well, the maximum of the entanglement is still in the middle of the time evolution. Now, the time scale here is the small t, I should have denoted capital T, optimal in this case, because now you can actually read up the running time. So, for example, the red curve that comes down at, say, 250 or so, that means that 250 is the running time of that algorithm. So that's why you can read. So in this case, you actually find a nice correlation again. You find that the largest maximum value of entanglement corresponds to the largest running time. Those curves do not cross their borders, so to say. Let me finish one sentence. And you find exactly the same behavior with the function beaming.
You said there's a second algorithm that you looked at. So the case energy theory, you said you couldn't find a correlation between entropy or the same correlation between entropy and the running time because it didn't have a maximum.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed like you could use this this slope as
yes.
for that case.
I show you a little bit about that. Is that here? No, I have more search right now. You also see when you compare the two different distance measures, fidelity and geometry, distance measures, this shows qualitatively the same behavior. Again, we have, if you have a large initial distance, you have a large running time, what do you expect? It gets more interesting when you look at the time delimiters, but let's go to the search of the Deutsch algorithm. On the left is, again, the adiabatic evolution with a non-optimized time. So that's kind of cheating again because you just reproduce the classical result, right? You don't have the speed up. So there you have the maximum of entanglement where the fidelity changes constant. Let's see. Now, if you do that, if you use an optimized monitor, you see that the rate of change of your fidelity is actually smoothed out. You don't have a maximum anymore. You have, for the largest part of the algorithm, you have a really almost linear function. And you see the entropy of entanglement is flatter as well. Yeah, that's what you see from, well, the difference between non-optimized and optimized part of time. Now I have a few results for 3 qubits. Just for the distance measures again, you find the same as you find for 2 qubits. When you're far away, it takes you long to get to the final state. And you find the same behavior when you compare the non-optimized with the optimized running time. Again, your rate of change of fidelity is flattened out, just even more extreme in this case. And the maximum of the entanglement is flatter, although I cut off the numbers. Sorry about that. What is interesting when you compare these two figures, when you look at the entropy of entanglement and this geometric measure of entanglement, what I was hoping to find would be if you do this with 3 qubits, that this new measure of entanglement would show you which of the qubits should be traced out. Because we kind of single out the first qubit in this case, just because we define the Markov state to be the 1,0,0,0. So we have a kind of special case there. So I would have expected that this shows you if you do the entropy of entanglement by tracing out qubit 2 and 3, the result should be qualitatively the same as with the geometric entanglement, is not, at least not for all cases. You see that the order of the maximum is different. So in this case, you do not have the correlation highest maximum value of the entanglement at last one. You have it for a few of the cases, but not for the general case. So that's too bad. You find the same thing, by the way, for the unoptimized. When you compare those two matches. Here's a little bit for the Deutsch algorithm when it comes to the derivatives. We can just look at which one produces the entanglement faster, just in the beginning. And what you find is that the states that generate entropy faster, entanglement that should be, have a shorter running time. So this again could say entanglement is a kind of resource. But in this case, again, you don't know which one is first. You don't know the chicken and the egg. So these are kind of preliminary results because we are still investigating. The least surprising, what you would expect, is that when you have a large initial fidelity, you have a small running time. And you find that for the traditional fidelity as well as for the distance measure that just doesn't comport. When you consider the search algorithm in the unoptimized version, which does not give you that speed up, you find that the rate of change of fidelity is largest where the entanglement reduction is largest. So you could consider that a resource, again, the entanglement, because, well, there's a lot of entanglement, apparently the time evolution goes fast. If you use the optimized time, that flattens out the rate of change of the fidelity that you have. And in that case, you find that the initial states that produce more entanglement have a larger running time. This sounds kind of contradictory with what you find before, that entanglement could be considered a resource. Because this partial result sounds that entanglement is bad. But again, we do not know which one, which physical quantity drives the other. So is it there that if you start further away from your final state, meaning if you have a larger, a smaller initial fidelity, that it's, the running time is larger because of that, and the entanglement is just made larger because you start with that? Or is that entanglement the actual resource for it? We still. And for Deutsch algorithm, we just have a little bit, we know that the states that generate entropy more quickly have a shorter run. Now, there are many questions, much to work on. So which one, fidelity of entanglement determine the running time? Do they determine both? How they are they related to the sign of the Hilbert space, etc.? The problem, especially in this case with the adiabatic model, is when you change the initial state, you change the initial entanglement and fidelity, but you also change the Hamiltonian, which means you change the interaction, which means you change the entanglement which is produced and destroyed during the running time. So how could you keep that possibly separate? I don't know yet how to do that. And it would be nice if you could compare these two measures of entanglement, possibly even another one, to make conclusions about this partition question. So here's my wish list to myself and to anybody else who is interested in working on this kind of stuff. Larger systems would be nice to consider. That's more a numerical thing to do. So that should be possible in the near future. It would be nice to have more algorithms. There's a serious lack of algorithms that you could study. So it would be nice to have more of that. One of the possible algorithms that we want to look at is structured search. We looked at structured search a while ago. The idea is when you consider the Hamiltonian search algorithm, if you write it down for, say, spin system, you see that it couples all the spins, or the whole system, which is, of course, not very realistic. So if you break that up, those interactions between just two qubits, three qubits, you get this structured search, and you have a shorter running time. So if you consider that case, you have, you know, less interactions and a shorter running time, so you have less entanglement, that would be interesting to see. That's that correlation again. Then we could go from the combinatorial search, the IKEA, to spatial search. That would be one of the steps that I mentioned before, going from the quantum mechanics to the field theory, including one of the spatial dimensions, small step towards. And of course, it's very interesting to consider what the interactions in the Hamiltonian do, how they are related to quantum phase transitions. This Hamiltonian that you write down in general for the adiabatic quantum computation looks like it comes from the right hand for quantum phase transition. So what is the relation there? It would be interesting to see if that computation that is done in one of these adiabatic algorithms resembles a quantum phase transition. Because, well, this dynamics of entanglement that we are looking at could be compared to the dynamics of entanglement such as. And in general, it would be nice to, well, consider more the definition of it. How do you do it? How do you extend that, for example, to multi-partner systems, to particles in the sense that you actually have identical particles, thermal system, etc. It would be nice to apply them to particle physics. I've seen very few papers considering HPT and such things in particle physics. So, yes, yeah, just a welcome. Thank you very much for your patience.
Any questions?
I have one. So people have talked about some entanglements in the context of the quantum computation in the ordinary circuit model. And there the partial results have been so that with Joser and Lindemann's resolved it the entanglement is always in blocks which never get bigger than a certain size. You can simulate the whole thing classically and then deep rate results in a similar spirit. And yet, as far as I know, no one knows if, because those are the pure states. The computation can be a mixed state. Suppose it always stays separate and you simulate it classically on all the lasers. Well, so the question was, I mean, is there any connection between questions about entanglements in the usual circuit model and questions about entanglements in the adiabatic model? Why are they just, could it be a case that entanglement is important in the one case and not in the other case?
I've wondered about that. I wouldn't think it would make sense, but that's just my first guess, my first impression. Because, well, first of all, if they are computationally equivalent, you should be able to transfer results from one to the other. But on the other hand, they're the same physical system, right? So shouldn't there be the same physical resources?
Possibly, but it's not completely obvious to me. I mean, they're equivalent in the sense that if you can solve a problem in one, you can solve it in the other.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily mean that the same thing is happening when you do that.
That's true. My guess would be more that it might depend on the type of algorithm or type of computation that you're doing. I mean, there's obviously this difference between a search algorithm and something like a Shor's algorithm, for example. Search algorithm has been implemented in classical ways, so that's a pretty good hint that it's less quantum in a way, right?
Which was the word?
The search algorithm.
There must be some issue with increasing precision there if you want to scale it up or something.
I can look up the thing for you.
So, as you mentioned that for mixed states, mixed bipartite states, the measure of entanglement, there is no satisfactory measure of entanglement. So when we consider just the regular mutual information between the two systems, why is that not a very satisfactory? The mutual information between the two systems.
Okay, then you just have two systems again, right? Pardon? Or you're referring to the mixed state?
Yeah. Mixed bipartite state.
Yeah, for, I think that's probably accepted, right? But it's still a bipartite state. Not a multi-partite state.
No, let's say bipartite state.
Yeah.
Yeah. So why is that not a very satisfactory measure?
I don't know, is it? Is it generally used?
No, the point is there's no single measure that
It's not that there isn't a satisfactory measure, it's that there's too many satisfactory measures.
Okay.
There's lots of different measures, and some of them are good for something, some of them are good for other things, but they don't confer to each other.
So the mutual information would be a generalization of the Smith measure, the Smith measure that you mentioned, right, the previous case?
Not really. No. I mean, so for pure states, all the things basically are more or less equivalent. But I wouldn't call it a generalization.
So what I'm saying again is that in case we consider mutual information between two subsystems of pure state.
Yeah.
If that not to be the entropy, I mean twice the entropy of one of
So exactly. So for pure states, all these things are equivalent, but for mixed states, they're not particularly.
So what I'm saying is that if you define the entanglement measure to be the mutual information, it will turn out to be also the generally acceptable measure for pure states.
For pure states, yes. For mixed states, no. For mixed states, all these things are different.
One of the key problems with defining entanglement measures on mixed states is it's essential that you pick out stuff that is solely due to entanglement and not classical correlation. But if you just write down the mutual information and call that your entanglement measure, it is going to conflate classical correlations with entanglements. In other words, it's going to lie to you and tell you generically that you have more entanglement than you really do. Right, now if you want to look for a specific quantum effect, you do not want to have a measure which spuriously picks up classical correlations and then tells you that's quantum entanglement.
So you just don't want, for example, for just purely classical systems, you want to say that they really don't have any entanglement?
Yeah, if I can write down my state as a convex combination of separable states, then that state is separable,
mm-hmm.
right? But it may be classically correlated. Okay, so you want to be very quick and want to make sure that your entanglement measure distinguishes cleanly between those two possibilities. Now, for bipartite systems, if you have a larger than qubit CLAG model for size, right, the bipartite separability decision problem is NP-pop, right, which means there's no clean way of calculating. Right, and that's just a nice operational measure of saying, okay, if I want to make this state from pop, how much entanglement do I need to use? What's the least I need to use? Right? That's not the same as how much entanglement can I recover from that state by distillation procedure. But this is what Daniel, one of the examples of what Daniel was talking about how these measures become different. When it comes to simulating mixed states, there's a very early paper by the Apuranov and Ozefi Khan, I think from 1996 or so, where they look at states which do not have a block structure but are still separable, and they're not simulatable either. Right, so you've got to be careful about distinguishing between block structure, entanglement and simulatability, because you can have a state which is nice and separable, can be written as a complex combination of separable states, but it does not have a block structure and it's not efficiently simulatable. Right? This is why people are very cautious about saying that entanglement, or one of the reasons why people are cautious about saying entanglement is a necessary resource for computation, because in mixed states you can have a hard to simulate system which is still demonstrably separable.
So in a room, does it mean to say states not simulatable?
Well, you can't simulate it efficiently. Right.
Well, you have to.
Pardon?
What do you intend to simulate? What sort of measurement outcomes, probabilities of outcomes, or do you want to simulate?
I think the reason code was simulating the state equation, right, which is not the same as simulating outcomes and measurements, right? There's a definite distinction between those two possibilities. But if you want to look at the dynamics of the state, and that's what you're trying to simulate, then that's what you have. That's the appropriate measure of what are you simulating. So also with multipartite entanglement, you're going to get into difficulties because there's more than one kind of entanglement, and one needs to distinguish between the two operational criteria. I also recall a paper from a while ago, Mike Nelson and a bunch of other people, looking at the geometric measure of entanglement in Grover's in the circuit model. Have you seen that paper?
Yep.
Okay, put that on my hand.
Thanks.
So actually, was the relationship between the adiabatic quantification with quantum field theory in measure?
That's sort of hope that you just understand that, as I said, fully, if you have quantum mechanics, you can consider that here fully and just deal with just one dimension, right? So if you have this model and add a spatial dimension, you would be on the way to something like a field theory.
And you look between the version string of the field variables.
Oh, no, it's just expanding your model, your description a little bit. It's just that you don't have these, you know, qubits just connected by the gates, one step off the other. You just apply your time-dependent Hamiltonian to a system that you can describe as a physicist that you usually do. That's the idea.
So, see, so if, is it related to a quantum field? Can it relate it to a quantum field?
Hopefully.
So you're investigating several candidates for the reason for this quantum speed up, and you plotted the amount of entanglement in the system there for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And, but then, as you mentioned, well, sort of the time depends on the entanglement. It depends very much, fluctuates very much for the choice of the initial state.
Mm-hmm.
So then you could say, well, what's characteristic about entanglement then? But now here comes the question. Well, you could say that sort of the critical part of this adiabatic quantum computation happens where the gap is smallest,
mm-hmm.
because this is where you spend your time,
mm-hmm.
your runtime. And now, have you investigated how much the entanglement that you have in your system depends upon the initial state at that particular point in time? Is it more or less universal, the entanglement, at the time where you have the smallest gap?
It would be interesting to look at. I don't know. What
I mean, you could just look at your graphs, and maybe that would be interesting.
I mean, just the amount of entanglement just in the middle of the computation?
Yeah, where the gap is the closest. I mean, the question would be, is it a universal or close to the growth quantity, or does it still depend very much on the initial state?
Why would that be interesting?
Well, because that is the point where the computation takes place, when the gap is the smallest. There is where you spend the time, most of the gap.
Might be a bit artificial because of the way you construct the Hamiltonian. You construct it very symmetrical, but you don't turn on or turn off the one part and turn off the other part.
Well, right, so I mean,
so as soon as you
the time when the gap happens, that would be dependent on the detail of the Hamiltonian. And so I guess the question is, because if you ignore that and say the small gap is now,
mm-hmm.
look at the entanglement at that point.
Could you do that?
Yeah, the reason behind this question is, of course, if it isn't universal, how can it be characteristic of the algorithm? So if it would still depend very much on the initial state, then probably it couldn't be characteristic measure of difficulty.
Yeah. I just thought, well, the entanglement value that you have in the middle of the computation is the maximum value.
Well,
so
it wasn't so. For all the choices of the initial state, you started in your 2-qubit example, you started with the Bell state in the initial state, and then the entanglement was constantly dropping.
That's true. But as soon as you stay with the state that starts with zero entanglement and have a zero entanglement, you have this symmetric gain. So in that case, you can just read off the value of the entanglement at the maximum. And that's where you don't have the correlations. But yeah, your argument is good to say if you don't have that universality, how could that be?
Yeah, just a question.
Yep.
But the computation time also could depend on the transfers of the initial state.
Oh yeah,
because so I think that would be a correlation.
One more question. So you probably you probably did not ask whether entanglement is necessary or not. Actually, I have a suggestion that you interesting look at this problem of quantum state transfer. Say, for example, I have three spins that are collected by a inverse neighbor connection. And some years ago, Toby Cubis and Sirac prove the, that the middle speed has to be has to get entangled between something between another for the state to go from one state to another.
Mm-hmm.
So my speculation is that is yes, probably you can look at that point.
Okay.